Erev Tov. So I'd say Erev Tov during the 9 days, but on some level we still have to greet each other, at least we have a chance before Tisha B'Av. The topic that I want to speak about is Hegel, Jewish history, and the Mashiach. I have to give a sort of caveat. I don't know what people are expecting, but I don't mean to pretend that I'm an expert on Hegel, so if anybody is an expert on Hegel, maybe you'll have more than I do to say about him, but you're welcome to interrupt if that's the case. And when I say I'm not an expert, I'm not saying that in the same way as earlier this year, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik spoke in this very room, and he was asked a question about Yeshaya Leibovitz, that he wasn't an expert on Leibovitz, even though he had read every word that he'd ever written, but he still wasn't an expert. So when I say that I'm not an expert on Hegel, I don't mean it in the same sense. I mean it in what you and I would say I'm not an expert. Nonetheless, I have enough of an appreciation of some of Hegel's ideas, I have read some, to appreciate how it can help us in understanding our own tradition. And that's the way I propose to bring in some of his ideas tonight, but not necessarily as the main focus. And also, I think it's important to point out, again, I don't know what people's backgrounds are. I remember once speaking about Hegel in Los Angeles and being told, well, Hegel was refuted, so why bother? I'm not so sure that's clear. Again, not as an expert in the field, but certainly he is one of the philosophers whose influence is still felt. And anybody who's familiar with the writings of a political, very popular political writer who shares my first name, Francis Fukuyama, who is clearly a neo-Hegelian, so someone who essentially takes the same line as we'll speak about him. It could be some of you don't know what I'm talking about, but in any case, he is someone who follows that approach and is very influential even today. So that's something we'll get back to. We'll get back to Hegel. I'll explain what he has to say to us and why I think it's important in terms of the context of seeing Tisha B'Av from a God's eye perspective. Now, it's also quite a subtitle. I don't mean to be presumptuous enough to say that I can see what God sees. I think the last person who tried to say that was Bilam, if I'm not mistaken. But in any case, we will try to take an aspect or an approach to Tisha B'Av that is perhaps unusual and perhaps is a hopefully deeper understanding than that which we normally have, and I propose that to be the goal of this evening, to try to come to a deeper understanding of this time period in Jewish history from a religious perspective. I think a good place to start in terms of trying to understand what happened with the destruction of the temple and the tragedies that have come about as a result. Really, the destruction of the temple is not the complete focus of our mourning. In other words, yes, we're very upset about the temple, but we're upset about what it represents, and the truth is that it represents galut, it represents the exile, it represents the state that the Jews have been in since the temple was destroyed, and really from a little before that. As we know, the temple, as any historical event, is not something that happened overnight. So we're mourning this entire period, and I propose that we start from a very important personality that lived most of his life after the destruction of the temple, was very involved in picking up the pieces. And that personality is Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is a very unusual person in many, many ways. And his ideas, the ideas that we see in the Gemara, are fascinating as they are unusual. And I'm going to look at a couple of the things that he said in order to try to get a perspective on these events. One story I'm not going to tell you, it's very famous, a story that's related in Brachot. Anybody wants to look at it afterwards, it's Daf Samach Amud Bet, that's 60b. And again, the story is very famous. A story about Rabbi Akiva going on the road and wanting to take lodging in a certain city, taking with him a rooster, a donkey, and a candle. We all know the story. In any case, everything that could go wrong goes wrong. Right? He's not able to find lodging in the city. The rooster and the donkey are both consumed by wild animals, and the wind blows out his fire. At each juncture, the famous refrain of Rabbi Akiva is called the Avid Rachmano Tava Avid. Everything that God does, He does for the good. In other words, I'm not bothered by what appear to be calamities. In fact, they're not really calamities. They're something that somehow have positive meaning. At the end of the story, again, well known, marauders come into the city, and they would have taken Rabbi Akiva along with the others in the city had he lodged there, or even on the way had his whereabouts been given away by the fire or by the braying of the donkey or by the noise of the rooster. And so therefore Rabbi Akiva proves his point that in fact everything that God did was for the good. Now, it's a fine story, but as any story in the Gemara, it deserves further reflection. There are a lot of difficulties with such a story, and presumably Rabbi Akiva was very aware with the difficulties. Number one, this is not the situation every day. Not every day are we privy to such situations where we get into a car accident only to find out that that allowed us to win the winning lottery ticket. That made us a few minutes late and allowed us to win the lottery ticket. This is very unusual. You know, for every story, I hear these miracle stories. I don't know about you, but we hear these miracle stories about the World Trade Center, right, the Twin Towers in New York, and all sorts of other things. The guy who would have gone there, but he forgot his tefillin at home and he went back, right, and so on and so forth. You know, I hear also, but the truth is there are stories of the guy who missed the flight that didn't crash, and because of whatever reason also took the flight that did crash. We know that things don't always work out in such a fine way as in the story of Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva's life story is one that's full of calamity. Right? Is anybody who's familiar with the stories that we have about Rabbi Akiva, all the way down to his very death and martyrdom, know that Rabbi Akiva's life was full of productivity, but was also full of trauma. Right? We know about his students, right? According to tradition, 24,000 students who died in a plague. Right? Rabbi Akiva was constantly being hounded and persecuted, as was the Jewish people, by a very harsh Roman government. He endured the slaughter of the Bar Kokhba wards. Right? Rabbi Akiva's life was far from easy, and far from a gilded life wherein everything he touched turned to gold. So when Rabbi Akiva says that Kol Da'avid Rachmano Atav Avid, when Rabbi Akiva says that everything that happens is really for the good, it's very much a mystical statement, meaning it's something that one has to look beneath the surface to try to understand. And I think it's very much that mystical approach in viewing the world and viewing the events of history that can help us explain another very famous statement of Rabbi Akiva that I want to learn with you. And this story, again, is quite well known. At the end of Makot, the story of the foxes, right? Need I say more? Obviously a story that we speak about and hear during this time period. The Gemara starts a little bit earlier. I'm not going to read the whole Gemara. But in any case, the rabbis, Rabbi Akiva was with his colleagues, and they were coming closer to Har HaBayit, to the Beit HaMikdash. And as soon, the Gemara speaks, again, this is the last page in Makot, the very last piece. The Gemara says, Kiven Shehi Lahar HaTzofim Karu Bigdehem. This is an important detail we'll get to later. When they got to Har HaTzofim, Baruch Hashem, today we all know where Har HaTzofim is. Right? It's not simply a place name, right? Down the road to the left, a couple miles down. Right? Har HaTzofim, as soon as they got there, they tore their clothes, as is the halakha, that we're supposed to tear kriya on viewing the Har HaBayit. That's where you can see the Har HaBayit. In any case, Kevan Shegiu Lahar HaBayit, once they reach the Temple Mount, Raushu Al Shi'atam Beit Kodesh HaKadoshim, they saw the fogs coming out of the structure that had been the Holy of Holies. Hitchilu En Bochin, the colleagues of Rabbi Kiva started crying. Rabbi Kiva Mitzachek, right? Rabbi Kiva started to laugh, and they questioned him. Why are you laughing? He asked them, why are you crying? Okay, we're going to skip what they had to say. It's not so important for our discussion. So Rabbi Kiva explains what they asked him. They said, well, how in the world can you be laughing? This is a tragedy. You see that this structure, the Kadosh Kedoshim, the holiest place on earth, and you have a wild animal coming out from the holiest part of the holiest place on earth. So Rabbi Kiva says, and again, it's a little technical, but he says there are two prophecies that the Torah, or the Tanakh rather, seems to connect. Right? And they are the prophecies, and here also you have to do some background work. There's some questions that are asked about this, but for our purposes, it's not so important. It speaks of the prophecy of Uriah and the prophecy of Zechariah. So he says, according to Rabbi Kiva's understanding, he says that the Tanakh, the scripture, Tala Katuv Nevuatosha Zechariah ben Nevuatosha Uriah. Says Rabbi Kiva, it appears that the two prophecies are connected. Well, what are they? Uriah Ktiv, Lechem, Biglalchem, Tzion Tzadeh Techorosh, that because of you, meaning because of your sins, speaking to the Jews, the Zion, right? The Mikdash, Yerushalayim, has become a plowed over field. That was the prophecy of Uriah. The prophecy of Zechariah, the Zechariah Ktiv, Od Yeshbu Zkenim Uzkenot Bechovot Yerushalayim. That this is a prophecy of redemption. The first one was a prophecy of destruction, the second one was a prophecy of redemption. What's going to happen? One day there will be the old men and the old women sitting in the streets of Yerushalayim. A sense of tranquility, of peace, of being back home in the best sense of the word. Now, Rabbi Kiva says something very interesting here. I want you to listen carefully. He says, Ad Shalom, remember he feels that the prophecies are bound together. He says like this, Ad Shalom nitkayma nevuato shel Uriah, hayiti mityaresh lo titkayem nevuato shel Zechariah. Until I saw that the first prophecy of Uriah came to be, I was afraid, said Rabbi Akiva, that the prophecy of Zechariah would not come about. Achshav shenitkayma nevuato shel Uriah, now since the first prophecy has come about, beyadua shenevuato shel Zechariah mitkayemet. Now I know for sure that the second prophecy will also come to pass. And his colleague said about this, nechamtan. We've been consoled. Thank you. We've been consoled by what you're saying. Okay? It's a very strange thing. It's a very strange Gemara, a very strange discussion. But most of all, what I found strange is what Rabbi Kiva seems to be saying about prophecy. He said, I wasn't sure. Right? It's true. This is a Navi Hashem, a true prophet of Israel, who prophesied in the name of God. I really wasn't sure if it was going to come true or not. I didn't say I wasn't sure if I understood it or not. Or if it did, it had a different meaning. So I wasn't sure if it was going to come true. And it came up. Right? Mitiare Haiti. I was afraid that it wouldn't come true. until I saw that the other prophecy came true. Now I know the second prophecy will also come true. And that was why Rabbi Akiva was laughing. He was laughing, presumably, in some sort of joy at seeing the works of God come out in this particular way.
Yeah. He's not one of the Nevi'im.
He's not correct. I mean, he's, again, it's a whole, look at those parts, it's a whole discussion.
Okay.
Yeah, but in other words, he's viewed as a Navi of the biblical period.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Okay. In any case, I said the first Gemara may help us understand the second Gemara. Right? Rabbi Akiva, we said, as a mystical approach to the events that unfold in front of us, both in personal history, but even more significantly in human history, in Jewish history. Now, one of the commentaries on the Gemara, the Eitz Yosef, was a commentary on the Ein Yaakov, which takes all the Agadot of the Shas, of the Gemara, and collects them and then explains them. So one of the commentaries says that it can't be that Rabbi Akiva doubted that a prophecy would come true. What was his issue? I mean, again, it seems to be what he says, but what was his issue according to the Eitz Yosef is that the second prophecy could not happen without the first prophecy. In other words, the issue is not whether prophecy comes true or not. And Rabbi Akiva was waiting, well, let me see. Let me see if God really comes through. And if he comes through with the bad stuff, he'll come through with the good stuff. Right? But rather, the issue was that you can't get to step two without passing through step one. In other words, the only way for the prophecy of redemption to come about is for the prophecy of destruction to come about. And he doesn't explain why that should be. He only tells us, I don't have it in front of me, he gives a hint that this is a mystical perspective. But he doesn't explain it to us, presumably also giving fuel for us to believe that he's speaking, he has a Kabbalistic understanding of this Gemara. One has to ask the question, why should this understanding, assuming the Eitz Yosef is right, you have to go through step one to get to step two, what was the laughter about? Everybody was laughing. Rabbi Akiva said, you know, let's have a party. The fox is coming out. It's a great thing. Right? So what's all the great humor? What's all the great happiness about? Now I see that step one came, so we'll get to step two. One could say that b'diavad, you know, they tore their clothes, they mourned. But once you're in the situation, at least look forward to the good that's going to come. But in other situations, we've said, I'd rather not get the good as long as I don't have to take the bad. In other words, is this really a nechama? Is this really a consolation? I would much rather the God hold back the destruction and I'll forego the redemption. But again, I think Rabbi Akiva looks at it in a deeper fashion. Again, Rabbi Akiva is known to be a mystic. And I want to just point out that, as I mentioned before, the Gemara started off, at least the part that we quoted, that Rabbi Akiva also mourned. In other words, while he sought meaning in history and was able to see the delight in that meaning, he also was able to be human. God wants us to be human. When there's destruction, it's important also to mourn. When there's pain, it's important also to respect and to feel that pain and to console others. But at the same time, while that's human, to seek the divine within our pain and to seek meaning within destruction is coming close to the divine. I'm going to go to Hegel, but before I do, I'm just going to give you an idea of where we're going. I'm going to present a view of history, of Jewish history, that's very naturalistic, meaning that flows in very human ways, that is not al pi nes, that is not guided by a constant intervention of God. And I'm going to present that as Rabbi Akiva's approach. And I'm going to do that by way of introducing us to Hegel. But before I do, I think it's important to point out that it wasn't the only road, the road of natural history leading through calamity in order to get to redemption, was not the only road available. It was the much more likely road, because humans are human. But there was a possibility for the Jews to climb above that and to acquire redemption me'al derech hateva, without being involved in natural human history. And the decisive point in our history was, again, the rabbis encapsulated in beautiful fashion, the moment of truth was the decision to send out the spies, to live within natural law, to plan war in a natural way. And the almost inevitable consummation of that idea was that there would be a calamity and that the Jews would be doomed to go through natural history, which requires, natural history, I don't mean the history of animals and plants, I mean the normal human history that's not infused with divine intervention. But they would be doomed to go through natural history in order to reach redemption. And as I said, Chazal encapsulated that idea beautifully by saying that when the Jews cried at the Chet HaMeraglim, right, when they believed the story, believed the approach, or not even believed, but endorsed the approach of the spies who said, naturally we can't take over this land. When they endorsed that approach, what they did was essentially say, we're not prepared, we're not able, we're not desirous of living a miraculous life. As we'll get to later in our talk, the only one who had a different approach, more than Kalev and Yeshua, was Moshe Rabbeinu. Because Moshe Rabbeinu was able to embody the spirit of living beyond nature. But as far as the rest of the Jews, as Chazal say, once there was this bichiyah, once there was this cry, at that point the Jews became destined to bichiyah ledorot, a perpetual crying. But that set the stage for what we will call a natural process of history. But let's go to Hegel to try to understand a bit about human history. Hegel is perhaps the greatest philosopher of history, not historian of philosophy, the philosopher of history is a big difference. He was perhaps the greatest philosopher of history to have lived. Again, there are many who feel his work is dated, others who do not. But what he attempted to do was to try to understand reason in human history. And he does so very interestingly, at least this is the presentation that he gives in his introduction to the book that's given the original title, Philosophy of History. That's a joke. It's not the original. But in any case, in his introduction, he explains that what he's trying to do by trying to understand history is to see God, the rational God that he believes in the world. He presents it as a theodicy. In fact, I can read you his own words. Again, this is towards the beginning of his introduction. He says this about how he wants to treat history. He says, our mode of treating the subject is in this aspect of theodicy. Theodicy means justifying God, right? Usually used in trying to explain evil in the world. Right? In any case, he says that what he's trying to do is on some level theodicy, so that the ill that is found in the world may be comprehended, and the thinking spirit, by which he means God, basically, reconciled with the fact of the existence of evil. Right? Reconcile the fact that God exists in the world, and yet there is evil in history. He says, he continues, indeed nowhere is such a view more pressingly demanded than in history. And it can only be attained by recognizing the positive existence in which the negative element is a subordinate and vanished and vanquished nullity. Right. Hegel, who lives in the 1800s, I used to say in the previous century, but it's no longer, was living in a time period where religion was still a very viable option for philosophers, and in fact for many was something that even if they were not religious had to at least appease. If you look, it's very interesting, the, I don't know how many people have read the Origin of the Species of Charles Darwin. There's a back section where he tries to explain his views in consonance with biblical religion. Because again, that was something that at least on paper one had to do. So it's hard to tell who is a sincere, who's sincerely religious and who's not sincerely religious. But at least the way Hegel appears and presents his introduction, he's looking to find God in human history. And as a result, he comes up with an idea that he calls dialectical, meaning that history moves from one phase onto another phase, constantly moving upwards, though with all sorts of difficulties in its move upwards. For Hegel, that upwards is represented by coming closest and closer to human freedom. Freedom is very important in Hegel's worldview. But in any case, he goes through various large stages in history and shows how man comes closer and closer to that ideal. He says something very interesting, though, in our context about destruction and the need for destruction. It's actually, he rings quite poetic in speaking about the destruction, not of Jerusalem, but I don't remember if exactly Roman Athens, but something to that effect. In other words, I don't know how many of you have been to the Parthenon in Athens or the Colosseum in Rome, but says Hegel, one feels sad. One feels sad when viewing the destruction of these great civilizations. And again, in his religious quest, he doesn't want to feel bad about that because he wants to understand God in the world even in destruction, and compares human events to the mystical phoenix. I don't know how many people of you know or remember about the phoenix. The phoenix essentially is this mythical bird that prepares its own death. Apparently, it builds a fire throughout, I don't know how much of its life, and builds it and consumes itself on the fire. And from the ashes of the phoenix, a new phoenix emerges. Right? It through its death, it creates new life. And based on that image, Hegel says as follows. He says, change, while it imports dissolution, meaning the change brings about the dissolving of things, that's the way of change, involves at the same time the rise of a new life. Beautifully, that while death is the issue of life, life is also the issue of death. Right? Issue meaning that which comes out of. In other words, just like death comes out of life, life also comes out of death, right? And he continues speaking about the way of things that the spirit, this is a catch-all word, Geist in German, consuming the envelope of its existence does not merely pass into another envelope. It comes forth exalted, glorified, a pure spirit. In other words, destruction of a certain idea, a certain mode of being, a certain civilization even, is not mere destruction, but is a means to a greater end. So says Hegel, at the very least. And I would recommend a source that I've quoted before, I don't know if any of you have heard it, but I would encourage you very strongly, a Torah Tmima, in the beginning of Bereishit, about the sixth day. Right, when God says that the sixth day was Tov Me'od, so the Midrash tells us Tov Me'od is really an allusion to death. Right, very good is, death is very good. Everything else is good, death is very good. The Torah Tmima explains very much along the same lines as Hegel, that without death, there's no progress. Not just like the phoenix, explains Hegel, that simply creates life from life through destruction of the first life, but rather by destruction of the first phase, or by the previous phase, if you will, there comes the seeds of a new and better phase. So explains Hegel. And I think that maybe Rabbi Akiva might have been alluding in the very curious Gemara and Makot that we saw before to the same idea. What I'm suggesting about Rabbi Akiva's very strange statement of if one prophecy did not come true, neither would the other have, is exactly what Hegel is telling us. That in order for the higher level of spirituality, of existence that we associated with redemption, with Geula, with the final Geula, with Yamot HaMashiach, there needs to be calamity, there needs to be destruction. Again, at some point, if one wants to avoid that road and to go Me'al Derech HaTeva, as the Jews might have had a slight chance in the Midbar, it's not the expected road. And once the Jews did not take that road, then it was inevitable that they would face some sort of destruction. Whether it had to take this particular shape, again, that's something that only God is aware of. But Rabbi Akiva knew that there would need to be calamity and there would need to be destruction in order to lead ultimately to the redemption. Now, I would be a little more hesitant about presenting this. I mean, I think it's a good idea, but I would be a little more hesitant if I was not encouraged by the appearance of more than a little bit of the Hegelian approach in the thought of another Jewish mystic who lived after Hegel, not so long ago, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk. Rav Kuk speaks about Jewish history. That's why I have a couple sources for you. We're not really going to get into the first, I don't think. But the second one we'll look at briefly. Rav Kook is able to, first of all, I think by endorsing this approach, I think it allows us to interpret, or gives us more of an allowance to interpret the statement of the Gemara as we did. But perhaps even more important, Rav Kook is able to take this idea to the next stage and explain what still remains unexplained is within the context of Jewish history, why is Churban, why is Galut, which we said is really what we're speaking about, necessary for the final redemption? Why is it necessary for us to go through that stage? What does that stage bring to us that clears the way for the glorious redemption? Rav Kook, in his article, and he has several pieces on Jewish history, this is a short one that's found in Orot, goes back to speaking about Moshe as this unique individual, as we mentioned before, who transcended human history, and therefore didn't need to go through historical development. Moshe was human perfection. And that's why we have all the great things that we say about Moshe Rabbeinu. That's why he was able to, according to tradition, not eat, not drink. He was me'al ha'teva. But as far as the rest of us, Rav Kook says, we have to go through the process. And that process, as Rav Kook, is a tension that exists in accomplishing what God wants us to accomplish in terms of identification with Him, in terms of spirituality, in terms of ethics. That has to be accomplished through two distinct phases that focus on two different notions of spirituality. Says Rav Kook, is the great idea that's represented by the Navi, the great idea that inspires us that there's a God in the world, that we're able to pray to Him, that the concept of killing another person is anathema, that there's a need to treat every human being with kindness, with respect. Right? These great ideas, which when we hear them, excite us. We have a naturally responsive sense to the great idea. And the great idea was the tool, was the focus, really, of the Navi, of the prophet. And if you look through the Tanakh, you'll see that that's very much what it's made of, with one exception, and that's the five books of Moses, which we'll keep to the side for right now, because as we said, Moshe was a very different type of Navi. But your standard Navi is one who's speaking out, whether in narrative, whether in prose, whether in poetry, in Shira, is speaking out the great ideas and inspiring the Jewish people, and through the Jewish people, inspiring the world. The only problem, says Rav Kook, is that that's not enough. The great idea by itself is something that ultimately will fail. Because ultimately you need to define what you're speaking about. When we spoke about kindness, it's not so clear what that kindness is. What does it consist of? What about when you have a conflict of kindness towards one individual at the expense of another? We spoke about murder. What is murder? When is killing someone the correct thing to do, as much as it takes a spiritual price on us and on our souls? We have to go and study the pratim, the details. And says Rav Kook, that's the job not of the prophet, excluding Moshe Rabbeinu. It's the job of the sage. It's the job of the chachamim. And says Rav Kook, if you look in history, the two did not really coexist. In biblical times, yes, there was halakha. There was some development of the Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu gave us. But it was extremely limited. The focus of the Jewish people was on the Mikdash, was on Nevuah, was on inspiration. But as Rav Kook explains, that inspiration gave the people a thirst for spirituality, so much so that they were led astray to the constant attraction of other types of spirituality, of Avodah Zarah. And from that perspective was doomed from the start. The other mode of spirituality that we associate with the Talmud, with the looking for the details, with the understanding fine points to know exactly what it is we're supposed to do, says Rav Kook, that vanquished idol worship. But it came as at a great price, because eventually it also parches our souls. It, though it needs to come in its own period without the overwhelming competition with the great idea, by itself is also doomed to failure. Says Rav Kook, in Jewish history, there was a need for two great periods. There was a need for a state. It doesn't say it in these terms, but these are the terms that I'm using, my understanding of what he's saying. There was a time for a religious state, a state that embodied the great idea of Judaism. There was a need to be an Or LaGoyim, be a state that's very unusual and different and focused not on competition, not on selfishness, but focused on divine spirituality. There was a need for such an event to start the ball rolling. And this is the biblical period. But as we said before, and as Rav Kook will see, says in his eloquent way, that needed to be replaced. There was not room for two contenders to live side by side. And it appears that the only way to establish the second period was through destruction of the first, through destruction of the state, through destruction of the embodiment of the great idea, which was the Mikdash. There was a need to focus on the Pratim, to find God, as the sages say, in the Dalet Amot Shel Ha'alacha, in the four cubits of the details. And the result, for us, for the Jewish people to have a state, was something that was counterproductive. We needed to move on. And indeed, through the Churban, with all the pain that it caused, says Rav Kook, we did move on. We did move on to understand the details, to completely purge ourselves from the destructive wildness that comes with spirituality. But that was not an end either. And for Rav Kook, the end comes, he felt, in the synthesis, right? We spoke about dialectics before, right? A synthesis of the two time periods, of the two approaches, the two modalities of spirituality that have to coexist at one point, which translates into redemption, which translates into Geulah. Let's take a quick look at Rav Kook's own words. He speaks about Moshe as this unique individual. It was granted to Moshe prophecy of undimmed clarity, right? Meaning the great idea, that discerned simultaneously the claims of general principles, which is still the great idea, as well as the exacting demands of the particulars. Says Rav Kook, but there never arose another like Moshe. Moshe, again quoting from our tradition, Moshe was unique. He was an ahistorical person. He lived me'al ha'teva. It was therefore needed to assign the general principles to the prophets and the particulars to the sages. Going very quickly through history, in the course of time, the concern with the work of the sages, meaning in post-biblical times, the work of the sages predominated over the work of the prophets. However, says Rav Kook, at the end of this epoch, at the end of this time period where we're focused on particulars, when the light of prophecy will begin to have its revival, says Rav Kook, there will develop a reaction, a pronounced disdain of the particulars. There's a threat of destruction that meets the end of the second period. Now, the second period of Jewish history also has within itself the seeds of its destruction. And it's natural in history, says Rav Kook, for people to get very angry and upset with the halakha, which has parched us of our spirituality. We come out dry. And if you look in the literature of the Zionist, the secular Zionist movement, if you look at the literature of various other movements that were sprouting up before and in Rav Kook's lifetime, there was very much a sense that religion had nothing left to say, or the Jewish religion had nothing left to say. It was too busy worried about Mukseh, when everybody else was speaking about the dignity of man. It was speaking about the rights of man. Jews were very impressed by the ideological whirlwind was going on all around them. And they saw the rabbis and their students worried about Mukseh. And this upset them. And this brought about rebellion. And this is precisely the rebellion that Rav Kook is describing, that it appeared in his own time, which he felt was a natural result of inevitable Jewish history. In other words, there has to be an attack on the second period, just as there was an attack on the first period. There has to be some sort of destruction. But as opposed to the end of the first period, where we move on to the antithesis, to the opposite of the first period, at the end of the second period, we eventually need to move to bring the two together. So Rav Kook continues optimistically and says to us, this will continue until the radiance of prophecy will reemerge. And there are those that say that Rav Kook was seeking himself to become a prophet. People said the same about Rav Nachman. The Eish Kodesh and others. There was a sense that we need the big idea and various greats of the Jewish people had a greater sense of prophecy, even though they were not prophets. In any case, he says, the radiance of prophecy will reemerge, not as unripe fruit, but as the first fruits full of vitality and life. And prophecy itself will acknowledge the great efficacy in the work of the sages. In righteous humility exclaim, the sage is greater than the prophet. This transcending of one-sidedness will vindicate the vision of unity expressed by the psalmist. Mercy and truth of meth, justice and peace of kiss, truth will rise out of the earth, and mercy will show itself from heaven. The Lord will also bestow what is good, and our earth will bring forth its bounty. And says Rav Kook, in beautiful fashion, the soul of Moshe will reappear in the world. This is, my friends, the vision that Rav Kook had of the Geula. But his vision of the Geula is something that only appears on the horizon at the end of natural human history. Again, I quoted Fukuyama before. His famous book is called The End. It was actually an article first called The End of History. The Hegelian notion is that history moves in a direction. And I think the mystical, as much as I know of it, or at least that I can tell from mainstream Talmudic sources and Midrashic sources, is very much in line with that idea that there needs to have been destruction, and as human beings we must mourn that destruction. But also to laugh at it, to rejoice in the fact that God exists in all aspects of human history as he does in all aspects of nature. And that when Rabbi Akiva said, "Kol ma da'avid rachmanu atava avid," that everything that God does, he does for the good, we, like Hegel, I think, are well advised to look for that, to seek in the footsteps of Rav Kook the beauty in history, even as it implies destruction. Because as Rabbi Akiva saw very clearly in his own mystical way, the only way to get to greatness is destruction. So let us mourn on Tisha B'Av, but let us also appreciate the divine promise of Geula that's been made possible by our ancestors, and let us pray that Rav Kook was right, that we're coming close to the end of history, to the final stage of history, and that we can take Fukuyama's title, The End of History, and say to it, Amen. Thank you. If there are any questions, I'll take questions. Yeah, please.
If Mashiach comes, so what is the one that you can consider is Al-Atev? So what is it going to change?
what I think happens is there's a natural way to reach Me'al HaTeva, and there is an unnatural way to reach Me'al HaTeva. In other words, Me'al HaTeva is the end point. The question is, how do you get there? Right? Because human perfection, which is what we're trying to come towards, Tikkun Olam, which in its own right is Me'al HaTeva, the idea, as you said, that there'll no longer be war or destructive competition, is something that on some level is quite miraculous. But I think the promise of Yamot HaMashiach is that mankind can get there. The only question is how. And Rav Kook is presenting a naturalistic road that man eventually, looking through what he has accomplished, looking what the Jewish people have accomplished, are able to get to that. And not everyone agrees. There are those that say that the only way we'll get there, realistically speaking, is for God to intervene. But this wasn't the approach of Rav Kook. Yes, sir.
There the concept of the inevitability of sin is compulsion in order to have redemption.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a good question. And I'm going to give you an answer on one foot that I may at some point want to rescind because I haven't thought it out properly. But my immediate reaction is that yes, on a national level, there is inevitability of sin, at least according to the approach we're presenting. On the individual level, and a similar approach that is taken in terms of Paro, Avraham Avinu is given a prophecy that that they're going to be treated very harshly in Mitzrayim, in a land that's not theirs. So people ask, well, does that mean that Paro is doomed to be the one to do it? If so, why should he be punished? God preordained it. So one of the answers given is that he himself is not preordained. It's preordained that someone will do it. The question is, who's going to step up to the bat? I would say the same thing is true here, that there is tremendous forces set in motion that will push the Jews as a whole to a situation where their sins will bring about destruction. But on the individual level, the person would still have a free choice. Yeah. Sure. So again, at Rav Kook, I think I pointed out that there's a difference between moving from 1 to 2 and 2 to 3. 1 to 2... one essentially has to be put to the side, whereas 2 to 3, the two have to come together, even though there's going to be all sorts of conflict in terms of how they come together.
Surely you're saying that there is some aspect of
destruction, okay.
But you...
Okay, good. Yeah. So, let me just answer the question that you're not asking, because I thought you were asking, then let me answer what I think you are asking. The destruction, at least in the early stages that Rav Kook is speaking about, essentially, as I said before, are movements that said, halakha is not what the prophets were speaking about. Let's get rid of it. We can love your neighbor as yourself is great, but when it comes to muksa, I'm not interested. That's essentially what that group would want to see happen, and we know many groups have done exactly that. Now, if you're asking what does Rav Kook envision as the compromise, if you will, that halakha has to make to the great idea, on some level I identify with that vision, so it's a very personal answer that I'm giving, that halakha, I think, has to accept its role as the outer embodiment of an idea, but not more than that. In other words, I think halakha, and this is at the Kardoz Academy, which I'm very involved with, is a major theme, that halakha has sort of transcended its own proper role in Judaism. Halakha is a way to express an idea. When I keep Shabbat, it's an idea that I'm expressing. But unfortunately, because of the historical situation, we've come to a point where all we're expressing is the halakha itself. So I think halakha has to move over, in other words, the guardians of halakha, the Rosh Yeshivot, the poskim, have to accommodate themselves to the idea that in fact halakha may be a sine qua non, may be something that's fundamental and on some level more important to the preservation of the Jewish people than the big idea, but ultimately secondary to the great idea. Because after all, what it is simply a manifestation of something greater.
In the world of action, how do you begin to create that type of
change? So, we have to start at home. We have to be willing to buck the trend. I mean, destruction is going to be the hardest amongst the people that are most entrenched in halakha as the end all. But we all are very influenced by that vision of Judaism. And I think it's important to realize that that is a highly problematic vision. And that has to be expressed. We have to introspect. We have to introspect about how we observe halakha, why we're observing halakha. Content of Jewish education, which is something that we rattle over and over about, on and on about, rather. I'll give you just a very concrete example in that context. Jewish education, at least for boys and young men, is focused very much on dry texts, specifically halachic texts. And throughout the religious spectrum, there are very few people that are willing to experiment with their children to try a different mode of Jewish education. And I say that from experience, because I try to convince people to start institutions that would look otherwise. But we're afraid. We're afraid because we have a certain system, and we're comfortable even if, for many people, they realize that it's a very problematic system that reflects a problematic ideology. But the bottom line is change starts at home. And the bottom line is, when we keep Shabbat, we can really keep Shabbat and not just keep halachot Shabbat. To do that even for half an hour on Shabbat would be a feat. I mean, again, that's who we are. It's not, you know, we live in a certain historical period. It's very difficult to grow out of that period and to be different. Rav Kook suggested that we're coming close to the end. He had the beginnings of Zionism, of religious Zionism. Today we live in a much less ideologically charged time. And as a result, we're not as clear as Rav Kook was that we're coming to the end of the second period. On some level, we feel even more ensconced in the second period than perhaps 200 and 500 years ago. But as you said, I think if we introspect and we start with ourselves, we can show others in our own little way what Judaism is meant to be, which will bring about that ultimate synthesis. Yeah, so again, what I said is when we keep a halakha of Shabbat, I think what we have to keep in mind is what we're remembering God as the creator. We're accepting our place in the spiritual scheme of things, that we appreciate and try to commune with God through halakha, that when I refrain from doing something, it's in order to do something else. In other words, when I refrain from halakha, it's not simply to refrain from halakha, it's to focus on God. And my day, my Shabbat, as an example, is the easiest example, is to focus on God. Well, let's take another example, tzedakah. When we give tzedakah, most of us, you know, write checks mindlessly as if it's a gas bill. Right? We have our gas bills, we have our electric bills, we have our tzedakah bills. And we check them off, and you know, we give a certain amount, we write the check, put an envelope. Tzedakah is something much deeper. It's communing with the sorrow and the need of one's fellow man, of showing solidarity with mankind, certainly with the Jewish people and with mankind as a whole. Every time we write, and I'm speaking to myself.
Now, is it kavanah or action? Now we should be out from dealing with or speaking to the homeless?
I think kavanah leads to action. I think the easiest place to start is with kavanah. Because once you realize that the what tzedakah is all about, then you will be motivated to go and express your tzedakah in bolder fashion. That's what I'm saying. It starts at home on a very simple level, but it's very difficult because we are all men and women ensconced in history. We're not Moshe Rabbeinu, but like all things, we have to strive to greatness. Thank you.